Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Tonight we ask, how close are we to finding a cure for aging? We have already witnessed an extension in human life. For the past few centuries, lifespan has increased approximately a decade per century. However, with this extension in life expectancy, we've also witnessed a significant increase in age-related diseases. Type 2 diabetes, Alzheimer's, heart disease, and others plague a large proportion of our elderly, amplify suffering, reduce productivity, and elevate medical expenditures. But what if we could slow or even end aging and prevent age-related diseases? Not just extend human life, but actually increase our so-called health span, or our ability to live longer and healthier lives. What if we could crack the aging code? Well, researchers, investors, and innovators, especially here in the Bay Area, are hopeful that we can accomplish this. So tonight we ask, why do we age, and what do recent advances in longevity science cause excitement? And are investors contributing to and impacting this movement, and how are they doing so? And what are the potential repercussions, both good and bad, of delaying or even evading death? Joining me in the studio tonight are three people who are involved in this movement. We start with Dr. Thomas Rando. He is professor of neurology at Stanford University, where he is chief of neurology and also works at the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System. He's also the director of the Center for Tissue Regeneration, Repair, and Restoration, a program in regenerative medicine combining expertise in stem cell biology and bioengineering. Dr. Rando is also the director of the Glenn Center for the Biology of Aging at Stanford and is deputy director of the Stanford Center of Longevity. Welcome, Thomas Rando.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
We're also joined here in the studio by Dr. Eric Verdin, and he is president and CEO of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, the nation's first independent research facility focused solely on understanding the connection between aging and chronic disease to increase the healthy years of life. Dr. Verdin is also professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, founder of the biotechnology company Acelin, and has served as a consultant to or has been a member of the scientific advisory boards of numerous biotechnology companies. Welcome, Dr. Verdin.
Good evening. Delighted to be here.
Great. And finally, we're joined by Dr. Jun Yoon. He is president and managing partner of Palo Alto Investors, an investment management firm focusing on healthcare. Dr. Yoon was formerly a radiologist at Stanford and has served on several corporate and nonprofit boards and is currently serving on the board of the Salk Institute. He's also published dozens of patents, scientific articles, and business essays. He recently launched the $1 million Palo Alto Prize to help end aging and has donated $2 million to fund the National Academy of Medicine's Grand Challenge in Healthy Longevity, an endeavor aimed at achieving healthy longevity by catalyzing innovation and scientific progress. Welcome, Jun Yoon.
Thank you for having me, Joseph.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We're open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. We'd like to hear from you. So I'm going to start with a question for all three of you, which is, what got you into this exciting area of science? Well, let's start with you, Jun Yoon.
Well, my interest in aging started in college when I studied evolutionary biology, and the role of aging and evolution was something that has been thought about for a long period of time, going back to the 1800s. And the debate has raged on to this day. And it seemed like a really interesting question to pursue. Now, after I went through medical school and trained and started practicing medicine at Stanford, it was also clear that aging is an extreme humanitarian need. We see a lot of suffering on the back end of life. All the success of healthcare innovation has helped people get to that stage. And even though the industry is doing a wonderful job, this remains, I think, the most vexing problem in science and clinical care. And I think it's an enormous humanitarian need. That's why I got involved.
Okay, so a humanitarian need, there's scientific inquiry of sort of what does aging have to do with evolution or evolution have to do with aging? Thomas Randau, you next. What was interesting to you about this?
Well, I came at this, first of all, from the point of view of a clinical neurologist, where we see just a tremendous number of age-related diseases, and always asking the question, what is it about the aging process that leads to the onset and the propensity to develop all of these striking diseases? From our own research, we were very much interested in the biology of stem cells and how stem cells repair tissues throughout life. Really what drove us to begin studying this at the scientific level, I think it's one of the greatest mysteries of biology, is why is it that we repair tissues less well the older we get? And our questions really were, do stem cells age? Is there a problem with the environment in which stem cells function? And most importantly, regarding this issue of health span, is there something we can do about it? Is there something we can do to enhance the function of old stem cells to make them behave like young stem cells and repair tissues in old people just the way we can repair tissues in young people? So that's what we study in the laboratory, and that really was the beginning of our research in aging has taken us to this point.
So similarly to Jun Yun, you're talking about how your clinical work, where you're seeing neurological diseases, degenerative diseases, and the suffering that emanates from them led you to kind of understand or ask the questions of how can biology, stem cell biology specifically, help to reverse that?
Exactly. We were really led us to ask the question, is do the changes that occur in stem cells with age lead us to this fundamental question of what is aging, how do cells age, and importantly, can we slow, arrest, or even reverse some of these changes that occur in cells with time?
Eric Verdin, your take.
Well, as a physician, the process of aging is one of the great biological mysteries that I think most of us involved in research have been aware of. So how I came to the field was in some way one the happenstance of basic research. We were studying a family of protein in the context of HIV biology, and it turned out that these proteins were not only involved in HIV regulation, but also played a key role in yeast aging. And so the convergence of the two pushed me to initiate a new line of research in the lab. And this is a really typical example of what basic research is all about, is being able to take advantage of these events that you cannot predict. And turns out a lot of what we had learned studying HIV and the role of these family, this family of proteins turned out to be highly significant for some process of aging. And so this is how we started, and this project has only expanded.
So there you're talking about how work in one area led you completely farther afield than maybe you expected. This might be an odd question, but was ego part of this? And the reason that I ask this, because I imagine there's a lot of people out there who want to live longer. They think they should live longer. And I know academics want fame to be able to say, I've helped contribute in this way. But I didn't hear any of you say ego. And what I'm really getting at here is how much is the interest in longevity in about one's own self-interest in living longer? And what I'm hearing is something much more altruistic here. And I'm just curious.
Well, I guess I would say that I did not, and still actually do not, approach this really from the point of view of living longer. It really is from the point of view of living healthier. Clearly, these two questions, you know, merge at some point, and people do talk about living longer. But I think the main advances have really been in driving us towards a lifespan in which we live healthier. We can hopefully avoid some of these age-related diseases. And in that sense, that ego part, I think everybody would agree, if we're going to live a long time, we want to live healthy. So that part, I think, is driven by, I mean, it's not driven by my own interest, but in terms of my own life, although we would love to think that everyone would benefit from this.
So you're coming, you've described what I understand to be the typical notion of what a health spanner is, right? And so I imagine, and I understand that all three of you identify with that notion, that what longevity research is about is trying to extend the lifespan, but do it in a way that avoids suffering, prevents or delays disease, but isn't necessarily looking for immortality.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that's where we get into trouble. When people start asking, are we looking at ways to keep people living forever? Clearly, a lot of the ways we study aging are ways to look at how animals live longer, and they actually do live longer. But nothing that we've studied has led to what would be considered immortality. And really, as we begin to think about how studies in animals may actually lead them to live longer, a lot of that still is about health span. It's about having them healthier longer. And as you go from simple organisms like fruit flies up to mice, up to humans, the effects are smaller and smaller so far. So in terms of extending lifespan, but we hope we can extend these from animals to humans in terms of extending health span.
And June, we're not going to be talking to any people who are call themselves immortalists tonight, but just to make sure we have a placeholder for that concept or that vision, can you describe to us what immortalists are looking for and what they're actually looking for? Immortality, I understand. Is that right?
You know, I actually don't know of people that are seeking that. I think that's I hear a lot about that in the media. But personally, I think most people in this field are serious about dramatic improving health. And the longevity is a consequence of staying healthy for a long period of time. So that's the framework that those of us in the field use. You know, I think the words like immortalist, it tends to cause a lot of fanfare in the media. But that's normal, I think, in a lot of fields, right? And this one happens to be pretty sensational. With respect to the question about ego, I think the desire to survive and live is an innate human trait. It's actually hardwired survival, right? But as it relates to this field, this is an extremely collaborative field. I think people really want to see dramatic improvements because we all, number one, all of us are physicians in this room. We see the suffering. And when you think about the humanitarian crisis, not only in terms of the bodily loss, but psychological loss, emotional loss, social losses associated with aging, it is tremendous. I mean, there are literally hundreds of thousands of people dying per week from aging and its related diseases. That would make it the largest humanitarian crisis on the planet right now, except it happens out of sight. The idea of ego, I mean, I think the people that are doing it knowing that it may not help those of us that are here, but why not give it a shot? We know that there are people on the brink. This is a great thing to do for the generation that's older than us. I mean, I'm in the middle of my life. I was told that when I got to this age, it would be a crisis. It doesn't feel that way at all, right? I mean, the people that loved us most are often around. The people that we love most are in the bosom of our families. You know, midlife it feels like the sweet spot. We have a chance to do something great for the people that begat us, and it's an opportunity to leave a great legacy.
And what motivates the people who are giving you're trying to raise interest and money and you're trying to give money out? What motivates others who are looking to fund this proposition?
I think there's various different motivations. Some of it's interest in science. I think there's diverse constituencies in this field. Some people are fascinated by the science. Some people love philosophy. Some people are interested from a business perspective. Clinical perspective. I think it takes the diversity of viewpoints, but it's all ultimately about improving human well-being and the trajectory of our society.
And you?
So, yes, I completely second what was just said in terms of the ego. I think for most of us in medical research, it is not the ego that drives our work. It is the joy of discovery, the sense of contributing to making our world a better world. And I think I also view our effort in a line of investigation that's been going on for 120 years. If you consider the fact that in 1900, the average life expectancy was 50 years old, and that we have increased this life expectancy by close to 30 years in the last 120 years, I think if we could continue this progression and 100 years from now have an extra 20 years of healthy lifespan for everyone, I think this would be an incredible achievement. I think this is how we look at our work. As a physician also, aging has emerged as one of the major risk factors for a series of conditions that we call the chronic disease of aging. And so as a physician, the ability to tackle processes that will impact on all of these conditions versus one at a time, as is currently done by basic medical research and current medical practice, is one of the biggest attraction. The idea, this is a paradigm-shifting way to look at disease, and I think we are all in this with the hope that we will...
Looking at more upstream, so to speak.
Yes, looking at the trunk. I mean, in some way, if you think about different diseases being the branches of a tree, we're going further upstream and looking at trunks, common pathways that are triggering diseases and affecting these pathways, with the hope that when we modify them, we will affect several diseases at a time. This is really one of the biggest aspects of this revolution.
So I want to start to narrow in on the science here, but let's start with the big question that you started with, Junyun, which is the connection between evolution and aging. So what is the current thinking about how evolution sees, so to speak, aging? What's the relationship? Is there an evolutionary reason for aging and death? Is it something else?
Well, I can't speak for the consensus, but I can provide a little bit of historical background on how people thought about this. There is a evolutionist named August Weismann, who was one of the successors to Charles Darwin, who basically broached the notion that maybe senescence is a tool of evolution to help help species and individuals get out of the way of the better versions of ourselves, our children, essentially. And maybe there's a selective advantage to have aging built in. That idea was around for quite some time until the early 50s, when a Nobel laureate named Peter Medawar said, senescence can only be weakly reflected in selection because it occurs after reproduction. So since then, that idea that maybe there's an evolutionary basis, an evolutionary advantage to having senescence, has been relatively unconsidered. Right now, I think it's back on the table a little bit. But those are things that you can't prove or disprove. I think they're just frameworks. If it helps you develop hypotheses that can be tested, great. And I think that's, some people espouse it, some people don't. And then it's going to get down to, okay, well, whatever your framework is, let's find an experiment we can run, and let's see if we can actually improve the outcomes in these ways that we care about.
Either of you want to add to that, the sense of where you see the role of aging as part of the grand plan of evolution, so to speak? Tom Rando, you want to start?
Well, I'll just excuse me, add to what June said. So I think the evolutionary theorists today would make this argument. They would make the argument that, for the most part, aging is outside of the evolutionary selective pressure. By that I mean, across evolutionary time, as species were being selected, there really were no old organisms. Organisms in general lived long enough to reproduce. And so this whole idea of a phase of life, as June said, post-reproductive, really was so short that anything that happened after that was not being selected for or against. And if that's right, then what we see as aging now in humans or in laboratory animals or in animals in a zoo or animals on a farm, where we protect them long enough so that they can go through this process of aging, is something relatively modern in evolutionary times. So if that's right, all of this we're seeing is actually kind of a secondary consequence of what has been selected for. So it makes it kind of an enigma, because in that sense, if that's right, there's really no evolutionary reason why we age, and so we're dealing with something that occurs but has not actually been selected for by any selective evolutionary pressure.
Do you agree?
Yes, and there are some a number of clear examples of this model. Is the idea that if a species, for example, has a predator that statistically will, let's say, kill most of the members of that species by 2 years of age, the species will maximize its reproduction during that period of 2 years. Now, if that predator is not present, and this has been documented on some unique species in the Galapagos, or for birds, for example, which is a clear example of a species which most of the time does not have predators, these species then make an investment which consists of maintenance and repair and end up living much longer. And so there's clear evidence that life forms are able to make these investments of repair and maintenance of their tissues and their organism, but they typically do this only when it's worth a reproductive, an extended reproductive period. If they're statistically, the organism is meant to be dead by a very short period, the investment then is on reproduction, rapid reproduction.
So we're talking about extending life way past reproduction, right? There might be some people out there who say, what is the advantage to living longer? And yeah, granted, you're saying if we can reduce suffering or eliminate some of the diseases that really impact people's later years, that can make them the quality of life really challenging. But some people philosophically might say, well, why would I want to live longer even if I could, and even if I could be healthy? What kinds of answers would you give them?
The answers vary, I think, on the individual. And I think what we're talking about is developing a tool that gives people potentially options if things work out. This isn't a mandate to extend life. This is an opportunity to be healthier. And right now, in many ways, we run out of time before things that we want to accomplish. In fact, I think the best resolution to the fact that we're all too busy now, everybody's getting busier, is to create more time. I mean, now we can decompress a little bit. There's this rush to get things done. And then just when you're starting to hit your stride in your 40s is when a lot of things start to go. Your bodily function, your sleep, your memory. Imagine the human potential you can unlock by being healthy for another decade, another couple decades. There's upside to that. There's also the downside we're trying to manage. The current system, for sure, is an amazing path, but it's risky because we're essentially treating the symptoms of aging. So we're helping extend quality and quantity of life, but we're not solving the core problem, which means we're essentially making more old people. They need more health care. So you can see how that becomes a vicious cycle. The current system is a vicious cycle of cost escalation, which you play that out, mm-hmm. Is going to be an economic catastrophe. So as good as the current system is, we need something different than the track we're on right now.
So you could see a larger benefit to society by saying that you're if you improve the health, so for as long as people are living, they're living healthier, you can decrease their healthcare costs and all the other advantages that come out of being more productive in whatever set of ways that one would define productivity. I want to pause here for a moment and reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing advances in aging and longevity science with three physicians from the Bay Area. Dr. Thomas Randow, he is professor of neurology at Stanford Hospital and Clinics, chief of neurology at the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System, director of the Glenn Center for the Biology of Aging at Stanford, and deputy director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. We're also joined by Dr. Eric Verdin, president and CEO of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging and professor of medicine at UCSF, and finally by Dr. Jun Yoon, and he is president and managing partner of Palo Alto Investors, member of several corporate and nonprofit boards, and benefactor of several prizes in aging research and innovation. It's time to hear from you, our listeners. What questions or comments do you have on this topic? What would you do personally to delay aging? Do you have concerns about extending the human lifespan? And if so, what are they? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So let's talk a little bit more about the research Doctors Verdin and Randow are involved. Let's start with you, Dr. Randow. You mentioned stem cell research. So tell us about, in a layman's way of understanding, how you're looking at stem cells as a way towards longevity, increasing the lifespan, but also delaying or deferring age-related diseases.
Our interests really stem from the idea that stem cells are important for maintaining and repairing tissues, and that's what they do. And that's true in tissues throughout the body, whether it's the skin or the blood or the bone or muscle. We study a lot in skeletal muscle. And yet, over time, these stem cells lose their ability in general to maintain or repair tissues. So with that question, we've begun to ask, why is that? And is there anything we can do to restore youthful properties to stem cells throughout the body? Our current research really does focus on that question, is what is it that's present, for example, in young stem cells that's not present in old stem cells? And through our research, one of the things that we found is that if you expose old stem cells to the circulating environment, namely what's in the blood from young animals, you can make old stem cells behave like young stem cells and maybe even turn them into young stem cells. So there's this idea that there are circulating factors in young people that are actually promoting this kind of youthfulness of the tissues and the cells, that if we can harness that, we could potentially develop therapies that would restore youthfulness to old tissues from old individuals and old stem cells. We have evidence from this in mice that this can work, and there's ongoing research now looking at this even in humans.
So, have you figured out what is in the secret sauce, as it were?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. So we have not. We and others have found things that change in the blood with age. There are proteins that go up, proteins that go down. We've analyzed them individually. Some of them seem to have these kind of pro-youth effects or pro-aging effects, things that go up with age. So the idea might be that one could identify a cocktail of factors that are important for promoting youthfulness, or a cocktail of factors that you might want to eliminate or suppress that promote aging as a way of restoring healthfulness to aged tissues.
And this I've seen it written as sort of, this is termed sort of young blood, literally. And that there are some experiments out there are trying to really kind of, how do you expose older stem cells, older tissues, older people to young. I mean, the science fiction aspect of this can be, you know, you can go off and imagine some movies that would emanate from this concept. But you're really literally talking about that there are factors circulating in the blood of animals, humans that are younger than those that are older, that somehow seem to be signaling things to continue to stay on course, or repressing things that would shut them down, basically.
That's right. I mean, it's not that different from typical endocrinology in terms of thinking about, you know, there's insulin in the blood, and yet some people need more insulin. Now, this is quite a larger scale in thinking about the whole biology of aging, but it may be that there are components of the blood that are controlling some of these fundamental processes that lead to cell and tissue aging, and that perhaps that can be harnessed and developed therapies to restore youthfulness to individual tissues. We think of this, again, as stem cell biologists, as a way of, for example, promoting healing of wounds. So stem cells heal skin wounds, but we do that much better when we're young than when we're old. But what if we could administer a compound or a set of compounds that would allow old tissue to repair well? You could increase bone healing or skin incision healings in older people to help them recover more quickly from injuries.
So using that trunk versus branch model that you were talking about earlier, Eric Verdin, with the stem cell piece, where are you at? What are you envisioning at this point? Is it regenerating end organs or tissues and sort of replacing parts as they fail? Are you looking even further upstream at this point?
So we're looking upstream. That is, the idea is, if we can understand these very early events that are leading to these multiple changes that we see in cells and tissues, that we could intervene at that level to restore cells back to their very early, back to the trunk. You know, so if cells and tissues are moving along this pathway from a young state to an old state, we're trying to move them back along that pathway.
Okay. Eric Verdin, what research can you bring to us?
So we are interested at the interaction between diet and nutrition and health span and longevity. And so this work is based on two key observations. One is, it's actually one of the oldest observations in the field of aging, from the 1930s. It was the demonstration that if you decrease the calorie intake in mice and rat, you actually can increase lifespan, and sometimes dramatically, up to 40% by a 30% reduction. So this was one of the earliest findings actually in the field of aging, and suggested that the organism is able to sense the amount of nutrient that it receives. Now, the counterpart to this is the obesity epidemic that we see in this country, and actually it's catching up in the rest of the world, which by itself is causing, for the first time in 120 years, a decrease in lifespan. So this past year was the first time that lifespan did not continue to increase over the last 120 years, and it's been attributed in large part to the obesity epidemic. So what we're interested in studying is understanding what is it about calories that actually signals to the inside of the cell in the organism and transduce a protective response when food is a little less than what one would eat under basic condition, and what signal is actually transduced when an excess of calorie is present. And so our work and the work of many people in the field of aging has identified a number of so-called nutrient sensors. So these are proteins or pathways within the cell that are able to detect how much calories are coming in, and they trigger either a positive or a negative response. So now the hope is that by understanding how these sensors are working, we might be able to trigger them in a more effective way, either via diet, via nutrition, or eventually in the future via small molecule drugs. And so this is the focus of our work.
And so, again, this is looking at how we create treatments. How much of this can people do right now? I mean, I imagine all as doctors, you would still say, you know, healthy diet and exercise. but you're looking beyond just what kinds of calories people consume, the amount that they consume, the amount of exercise. You're actually looking towards other treatments that can actually also augment or tamp down some of these effects?
Well, a critical direct application of this work has emerged recently in trying it from several papers showing that it's not only the number of calories that an organism eats, it's also how these calories are apportioned during the day. For example, out of this work has come out the idea that fasting or periodic fasting might have beneficial effect. And there are a number of studies, also so-called time-restricted studies, showing that the same number of calories given over a 24-hour period can have very different effects whether the organism is able to eat throughout the 24 hours or is restricted in its ability to access the calories for 8 hours. For example, these are experiments conducted in mice. If the mice are allowed to eat for the 24 hours, they develop all the classical complication of obesity. If the mice are eating the same amount for 8 hours, there's absolutely no complication. So this has brought back to the
front. So you mean if they had all of their eating in an 8-hour period?
The same amount of food. So it's not just pure number of calories. It's to allow for periods of fasting. And this has triggered what you probably have seen, a number of popular diets that are being tested. What we want to do in this field is actually bring the test and tried method of scientific inquiry to actually really demonstrate which of these diets is actually working. Right now, a lot of things is available on the market for people to self-experiment, but the truth is that we do not know which of these is actually going to increase health span or longevity.
Okay. And then, Junyun, what other models, scientific models, are out there that you can tell us about besides the stem cell and looking stem cell research and looking at and impacts of nutrition?
Well, I think one of the things that's really revealing about Dr. Rondo and Dr. Verdon's work is that there is a plasticity to the aging process, which means it might be being regulated and that there might be things that you can modulate around that. So I think that's really fascinating. One of the challenges, though, remains how do you measure aging? I mean, lifespan is a very weak biomarker of aging, as are the diseases of aging. They're surrogates, but they're pretty weak surrogates. The thing that has motivated me to engage and to put prizes out there in the market is to just develop another way to think about it and with new biomarkers. And this is getting back to first principles. Homeostasis is the most fundamental thing in life and biology. It's one of the first things we're taught in biology class.
For those who may not remember their biology class, remind us what that is.
Homeostasis is the state of equilibrium. And you're able to achieve that as the sum of your homeostatic capacity and all the stressors that are out there. I guess the easiest way to visualize this is the Weeble Wobble. The Weeble Wobble is a toy from the 1970s. It's like egg-shaped, and when you push it, it kind of self-centers. But that's essentially what nature endowed in us. It's been selected by evolution, and it's so effective that we don't realize we have it until we start losing it. So when we're young, we're not feeling healthy. We feel nothing, right, when you're 14 years old. And then at my age, you start to feel something. Okay, so what do I feel at 40? Now when I go on a roller coaster, I come out of it wobbling. I can't self-center. I can't recalibrate. My kids have no idea what I'm talking about. When it's 50 degrees out, they're in T-shirts, and I'm in two layers of coats. When I go into the mountains in Tahoe at 8,000 feet, I'm huffing and puffing, and I feel dizzy, and they have no idea what I'm talking about. Same thing with recovery from a wound, recovery from a late night, hangover, jet lag, all those things. I can't self-center anymore. Injury, bone break. When I go into a restaurant, my pupils don't open up enough, so everything looks too dark. So what if this is all one thing? What if a parsimonious explanation, the Occam's razor for all this, is lost capacity, lost resilience, is a good way to think about it. Lost robustness, lost coping mechanism, buffering, the ability to get to homeostasis.
Those or are the time it takes to get back to homeostasis.
Exactly, mm-hmm. But the efficiency and the time. So these are things that we can feel in our 40s. But what about things we can't feel, such as our blood pressure and glucose levels? When we're young, and when those things go high or out of whack, or homeostatic capacity, our Weeble Wobble self-centers it. And after 40, some of us, they stay high, and you know, maybe we give names like diabetes and hypertension. And that's what we're trying to solve. But when we fix those deviations back to homeostasis, we're essentially propping up the Weeble. So that's why we've solved the number, but the disease progresses. All these chronic diseases continue to progress, which is why there's escalating need for more and more therapy. So what if we could get the system to focus on improving homeostatic capacity instead of homeostasis? It's one more change. But it has implications for how we think about diagnosis. Maybe every test shouldn't be, we shouldn't be measuring like single numbers, but we should be measuring system dynamics, stress testing everything. Like what we're doing in annual checkups right now, measuring your heart rate, blood pressure, glucose, cholesterol, is like measuring, like a seismic scientist trying to forecast collapse risk of a building based on how much is leaning every year. No, what they do is they do resilience testing. They do stress testing. That maps much better to ultimate collapse. So, and we already know from data that stress testing of the heart maps much better to aging, to disease of aging, to biologic age, mortality rates. And by the way, not dying is a great way to promote longevity. So if we know that these things actually relate to biologic age, why wouldn't we use that in everybody? Right now, we just measure heart rate, which basically is unchanged your whole life. It just declines slightly. That's a very weak correlation. And then therapeutically, could we get people to augment homeostatic capacity, increase their biologic resilience, to see if we can actually improve function, which is essentially what healthspan, you know, is. We should see dramatic improvements in function, like your vision, your hearing, your memory, your balance. We're not there yet, but that would be an interesting target. So that's why we put out the prize, to focus on those two things.
This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're discussing the advantages in aging and longevity science with Dr. Thomas Rando of Stanford University and the VA Palo Alto. And he's also with the Glenn Center for Biology and Aging at Stanford. Dr. Eric Verdin, who's president and CEO of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging and professor of medicine at UCSF. And Dr. Jun Yoon, he's president and managing partner of Palo Alto Investors. And he is set out some prizes for longevity scientists to move the needle, as it were, on this area. We invite you again to join our conversation. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. 415-841-4134. Are you interested in living forever? If so, why or why not? And what would you do with more time? You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisions@KLW. So let's go to William from Belvedere. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much. It's always intriguing to hear these sort of magic bullet things. We're going to find out the particular thing, and we'll figure out the medication for it. There is, however, a problem, and that is that patents get issued, and then medications become much too expensive for society to afford. That's certainly true with the macular degeneration medication, Eylea, the Harvoni for the hepatitis C, and I could go on with some of the more esoteric ones that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. Can the guest, but when I also one of the guests, I hear investors, whatever it is, company, and investor companies, it's good that they're giving scholarships, but investor companies are interested in investing, and you invest in order to make money. And with the patent arrangements, you can make tremendous amount of money with medications. So what, if any, assurances can any of the guests give that these discoveries may be very good, but it may be that, particularly because of the patents that are issued, that very few people may be able to afford them?
Thanks so much, William, for your call. So what I'm hearing from William's question is you know, what's the equity? And I don't mean equity as in equity that you're going to get back, but the how do we make sure that this is equitably distributed, this resource, should it come? And how do we keep things affordable if we're really trying to make an impact broadly?
I'm willing to take the hit on that question. It's an economic question, and I'm an investor in this field. So, William, I'm going to just mention some numbers out there. You know, the overall healthcare spend in this country is about $3 trillion, and 10% of that goes to the pharmaceutical companies. So you can think about that number in the following way. $300 billion is what it costs us when we have a solution for patients. And $2.7 trillion is what it costs us when we don't have a solution. That's kind of the whack-a-mole of what we do to you in the hospital and in the ICUs and ERs. So service costs are the vast majority of the healthcare spend in this country. The thing about patents is that it encourages innovation. Drugs are not inexpensive to develop. That's unfortunate. And there are also many failures along the way. So, you know, for every drug that is successful, the numbers seem high. But in order to attract investors, investors want to be compensated for all the risk they take as well. So in the case of Harvoni, there are many failures along the way. The company came up with a drug that essentially cures Hep C in 11 weeks. And what it used to cost us before Harvoni came out was, this is a Pew study, it's $150,000 per 10 years for mild cases, $250,000 for 10 years for moderate cases, and upwards of $500,000 per 10 years for severe cases. So those are the service costs before this cure came out. So the $64,000 pill for the cure is actually, in aggregate, probably saving us money because we're not thinking about it that way. And the other nice benefit is that these drugs, they're high for a little while, and then they go generic, and they essentially contribute tremendously to the system at almost no cost. The thing that I worry about high prices. I worry about affordability. I think these are all very legitimate questions, and I think we have to figure that out. We also have to figure out if the drug costs, in some cases, are too low. One of the things that doesn't make headlines is the fact that many drugs are disappearing because no company wants to make it at those costs anymore. So these are like life-saving drugs, very basic drugs like cardiac drugs, neurology drugs, immune drugs, and even cancer drugs are disappearing by the dozens. I think there was an FDA study 10 years ago that showed that there were 170 drugs that have disappeared that are an emergent need, and they couldn't incentivize anybody to produce them. That number since that original study, I've heard, has almost doubled, the number of drugs you can't get because the drug prices are too low. Now, there are probably multiple different reasons why they've disappeared off the market, but ultimately those are things that economics could potentially reverse. So I think there are hard questions on both sides. Are drug costs too high? In some cases, do we need to incentivize companies?
And do you see that these types of medications, treatments, will be fit into the healthcare system in a way that would allow them to be accessed by people across the economic spectrum?
Thank you, Joseph. I should have integrated where the longevity field today, the way Dr. Randall and Dr. Byrne are doing their research. You know, essentially what we're trying to do is restore health, and that actually should be a way to dramatically reduce costs in many ways. We ought to get a whole lot more bang for our buck, and then dramatic impacting the aging process is a way to address the cost that's very attractive.
So we're not talking about people who are out there who, you know, who are going to just have the money to be able to spend this and not be able to share with others, so to speak. Eric Verdin, you're nodding there.
Yes, I think one thing to consider also for some of the drugs for which costs have been extremely high is partly based, in fact, on a restricted number of patients who are actually using these drugs. When we're talking about developing drugs against aging, I mean, one can imagine an extremely large pool of people who will take these drugs and a downward pressure in terms of pricing. So I think that's another thing to consider. But I want to second what June was saying also. This is the engine that fuels the discovery. And while academic centers such as Stanford or the Buck Institute are extremely good at identifying targets and preparing the groundwork for an assault on targets with small molecules, the heavy lifting, the hundreds of millions of dollars that it costs to develop these drugs, is taken solely by biotech and big pharma. And they need the system to incentivize them. And if we take this away by taking the patents away, I think we will do away with our drug development capabilities. So I think it's a double-edged sword. Clearly, there have been some excesses that we've all heard about, especially in terms of repurposing of some drugs, you know, being with extremely high price. But I think we should not throw the baby with the bathwater. The whole medical enterprise has generated incredible success over the last 120 years, as we were discussing earlier, and I think we hope to continue to work in the same system to bring the next generation of discoveries.
So let me put the phone number out again before we get to a couple of emails here. If you want to join our conversation here on City Visions regarding the advances in aging and longevity science with our guests, Dr. Thomas Rando, Dr. Eric Verdin, and Dr. June Yoon, please dial 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org or tweet us at cityvisionsklw. So let's go to a couple of emails here. We have an email from Joan, and Joan asks, what happens to our natural resources if we live longer and our population grows? How can the Earth handle this increased capacity? And maybe, June, we can talk about in general, what are some of the criticisms, what are some of the things naysayers are saying about this this area, besides this concern of how do we accommodate people living longer, more people being on the planet?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very relevant question. And it's one of the first questions that come up in this field. But empirically, we're actually observing the opposite. So when you look at the fact that about 40% of the world's population today lives in countries that are prosperous and have longevity. So these are, think about that as the almost half the world that has longevity. Their fertility rate has declined to the point where all 100% of them are now below replacement rate. So the replacement rate per couple is supposed to be 2.1. And if you look at China, Japan, Korea, they're all way under 2. America, Canada, Australia, they're under 2.
Although in some of those countries, those are due to political policies,
fair.
Right?
So, fair. China was, but right. The other countries not. And Europe, all of Europe is under 2. Now, you don't. This isn't the headline out there because the remaining 60% of the developing world, which also associated with the low longevity countries, are still growing in population and they're supplying us talent. We call that immigration. But the net effect over time, if you continue to promote longevity and prosperity and we spread that around the world, is that you would see these countries convert to the fertility model. And there's many social science reasons why longevity might be associated with declining fertility. They're all fascinating hypotheses. But the net result, empirically, it's heading in the opposite direction. This is complete opposite of the Malthusian fears about population overgrowth leading to competition, running out of resources, running out of everything was the narrative we were told, right? I mean, there was a book by Paul Ehrlich in 1966, Stanford biologist, who wrote a book called The Population Bomb. So since then, we've all been terrified about the fact that if population growth is going to lead to a lot of issues. It looks like, if anything, so far, the longevity movement is actually stabilizing, providing a stabilizing force in population. And maybe we'll find out this most scarce resource isn't oil or water. It's actually people. We might be in the human capital century, and the human resource century. If population really starts stabilizing, I think it'll really provide a very different perspective on how we think about resources in general.
And what other, as I mentioned earlier, what other sort of criticisms or concerns are you hearing out there about longevity science?
Not about the longevity science, but some people say, I'm not sure if I want it, right? And a lot of them come back later and say, you know what, actually I've rethought it. So I've been very curious as to why, and I want to hear Dr. Rando, Dr. Verne's perspective on this, because this initial reaction and the secondary reaction itself is information. It's almost like Stockholm Syndrome. We've somehow made peace with the fact that we're going to age out, probably sometime early in life. So the possibility that may not be the case, at least it'll be different than what we thought, is disruptive enough that I think it gives people pause. And then upon reflection, they start to really understand the incredible positive potential of what this means. So that's something that comes up early. It's like, I'm not sure if I want it. But then when we ask and survey people later, like, you know what, this is really interesting. Tell me more.
Let's actually go to a caller who may help us kind of think through this a little bit more. Sean from Walnut Creek, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering how you guys think society in terms of education, retirement, and politics will change to accommodate an older or an aging population.
Thanks for your call. So what you're getting at, what we're getting at here is what there's the science and what it can deliver, but then what's the rest of the reengineering of society that has to go along with that? Yes, Tom Rando.
So I think it's an excellent question, and clearly our institutions have not kept pace with our extension of lifespan. We have really increased substantially the number of people who are living to old age, well beyond retirement age, and yet we still have a retirement age that's really dated back to the mid-19th century of 65, when people basically retired and died soon thereafter. And that is just not the case anymore, and yet that has not changed. We've not changed any of our basic institutions of when we go to school, when we go to college, when we get our first job, when we have our kids. There's no extension of our kind of life course with this gift that we've had of 30 or 40 years of extra lifespan. So I would say the answer to the question that the caller had was there need to be changes, and there have not been changes. And I think there requires a greater flexibility in how we think of how we spend these years. If it's not going to be about 65, it's going to be closer to 100. We don't want to just tack on all these extra years at the end as if we've not really thought what to do with them, because, as mentioned, this kind of human capital that comes with this lifespan extension, if there's really health span extension along with it, provides this great resource of people who live longer, healthier, and able to contribute to society in a significant way. And yet we're very slow to adapt as a culture to this changing demographic. So I think it's a challenge we all face. There are complex political issues in changing retirement age, for example, or changing when we educate. Do we go back and get a second education? Do we go back and get second jobs? But these are topics that are being discussed. There are movements to look at encore careers, the second careers, trying to adapt, but we're very slow to move in that direction.
Perhaps that's the next follow-up show we have to have on this, is those people who are starting to look at the how we engineer society to accommodate and to celebrate or to harness what we're potentially hoping will come out of this. I want to stay with you. We have Tom Rando. I have another email here from Kate. Are we seeing successful uses for stem cells in human diseases now, and if so, which ones?
We have successes in using stem cells in human diseases, but they're not specifically the diseases of aging. So, for example, the classic stem cell therapy is bone marrow transplantation, where what you're really doing in a bone marrow transplant is transplanting the stem cell for all the cells in the blood. Now, that's done for people of all ages, including a lot of children with childhood diseases of the blood. So these are effective stem cell therapies, but they're not targeting, at this point, diseases of aging. I should add that the first successful stem cell therapy that's based on a kind of stem cell in the laboratory called an induced pluripotent stem cell was done in Japan, and it's for an age-related disease, age-related macular degeneration. So that really is a kind of a landmark point at which we're actually using an advance in stem cell biology to treat a disease of aging, and I think that's just the beginning.
Hmm. Yes. Eric, did you want to add something there?
No.
You're just like scribbling madly on your notebook there. But that's for you for later, I guess. Okay. So in the last few minutes of the program, it's the sort of what's on the horizon. What timeline are we really looking at here for developments that are going to actually be ready for the clinic? And then I want to end also with a question from one of our listeners, Kevin. We touched upon this a little bit earlier, but I want to hear a little bit more from each of you. What can we be doing now to extend our lives and improve our health? And how do these doctors live their lives with that in mind? So why don't we start with you, Eric Verdin? So what is your sense of the timeline to the clinic, and what do you do and plan to do to extend your lifespan now and advise others to do now?
Well, in terms of the entry to the clinic, there are two recent developments in the field of aging that are worth mentioning. One is a drug that was used for diabetes treatment, glucophage or metformin, is actually being considered as one of the first drugs that could increase lifespan and health span. And a large trial called the TAME trial is being planned and is in a fundraising mode. So this could be starting within a year or two if they're able to raise the capital. Another one is a company called Unity, which was launched from the Buck Institute in collaboration with the Mayo Clinic, is in the final phase of initiating treatments in humans also, targeting a unique population of cells called senescent cells. So the anticipation is that by the end of 2018, we might have the first result of such trials.
Okay, and what do you do to expand your lifespan?
Well, I like to quote a Jack LaLanne, who some of your listeners might be familiar with, who said that nutrition is king, exercise is queen, put them together and you have a kingdom. I think I try to combine exercise and parsimonious eating and some episodic fasting. And so these are the things that I personally do.
Great. Tom Rando, again, what's the horizon look like for you?
So I think the horizon is quite different than it was 10 years ago. And that's really the remarkable pivot, is that 10 or 15 years ago, very few people were talking about this question, about treatments or interventions that might extend health span and extend lifespan. That's changed dramatically. There's interest on the scientific side, there's interest on the investor side, there's obviously interest from the public, and we're seeing just an explosion, I would say, of investment, whether it's scientific or capital.
And in the stem cell world, how long till something hits market, so to speak?
So we're already at that point of trials being done. So it's happening even as we speak.
Okay. And what's your health
tip?
Well,
again, it's what your mother taught you, diet and exercise. So okay. Eat less and run more.
And Jun Yoon, what do you see next? You're the visionary at this table along with the others, but you're putting the money here out there. What do you see?
I try to expand my dynamic range. So I want to maximize my resilience, so I intentionally put myself out there in extremes. So I don't just eat vegan. I eat a bag of Doritos once a month to make sure I can maximize my range. I intermix meditation with severe exercise. I try to stay out in warm and cold temperatures. I'm trying to do the opposite of what the world's doing to us, which is to narrow our range. I want to go expanded.
And if you can tell us now what would be something that we couldn't that you can see that we can't imagine right now, that'll come out of longevity science. What do you see?
Well, it seems like it's inevitable we're going to solve this eventually, right? And so it's a matter of accelerating the timeline. And I think the journey will produce incredible human stories of endeavor, of collaboration, science, society, the kind of things that you talked about earlier. I think we're going to have to rethink almost every institution. And I think we're about to embark on a really exciting era, and we're at the inflection point now.
Well, I want to thank my guests, Dr. Thomas Rando, Dr. Eric Verdin, and Dr. Jun Yoon, for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Vision's page on klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Colin Peden. Tonight's show is produced by Kendra Klang. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week. Good night. And until then, have a great week.